time to meet Matt Dury, who's a pretty amazing guy. He started trying to figure out how to make prosthetic hands almost 10 years ago after a bike crash, and now the company he started, called Tasker Prosthetics, has just sold its 200th hand in the US. They are, we think, the world's first, this might surprise you, they are the world's first waterproof prosthetic hands. And it sounds like Matt is getting some pretty emotional reactions from people lucky enough to get one. He's in our Wellington studio and joins me now. Hi there.
Kia ora, Jussie.
Kia ora, nice to meet you. I think this interview began when I was approached by a bright spark who works as an engineer or something on your team, and he said, oh, you should talk about our prosthetic hands, they're changing lives.
Yes, I'll have to have a word with Doug later on to sort them out. That's right.
I can't even remember where it was. It was some event, and I thought, oh, yeah, we could do an expert segment on prosthetic hands.
Very good.
Do you know much about the history of prosthetic hands?
Within the area we're focused on, absolutely. So, prosthetic hands, that term covers cable-driven hands and motorized battery-powered hands and even hands that don't move at all, they're just static hands. So, I mean, for us, the bionic hand, if you like, came out about 2006 in the US, and they've been on the market now for well over 10 years, and they're starting to become a well-established product in the marketplace and relatively well-accepted.
This is your one?
No, so
this is just the generic bionic hand.
This is generic, yes. So we're quite late to market, and that we've only started selling hands in the last 18 months around the world. Yeah.
Okay, we'll get to what makes your ones different, but talk us through a bionic hand. What is it?
So a bionic hand is a hand that can pick up signals from a stump area of an amputee, and it's listening for minute voltage signals that the remaining stump area will have, and the user can effectively make those muscles move, and that gives us something to work with. So that's how it activates. And the bionic hand itself, there's a bunch of motors and a lot of software and a lot of electronics and a significant amount of design work, of course, to make that form of a hand do various grip actions, such as picking up a pen or holding an apple.
And does it correspond to what you're trying to do? So if you are trying to wiggle your thumb, does it know you're trying to wiggle your thumb, or is it a bit more indirect than that?
Look, I wish they were quite that good. At the moment, the input systems for hands is a really fast-growing area. And at the moment, it's pretty coarse in that there are a range of motions a user can do, but it's unlikely they can wiggle their thumb and their thumb will wiggle. Generally, it's a pattern system where they'll be able to think open or close, and the hand will open or close or form some grip pattern, but not that individual control that we'd so love to be able to do.
Mm. And so tell me about those early bionic hands. What was good about them and what wasn't so good?
Yeah, well, so the technical term in the market is a multi-articulating hand, which refers to the fact that there's lots of motors in these things. So these multiple motor hands, multi-articulating hands, have although they came out well over 10 years ago, as we say, what became apparent very quickly is the users of these devices will push them as hard as they can till they break. And the designers of those original hands didn't necessarily anticipate the use that they would get. And certainly fragility has been a huge issue for this whole market segment in trying to actually make something that'll last for a user more than a few months.
Right. Because if you say squeeze, it just squeezes and squeezes. Is there not so much sort of relativity built into it?
Well, that's one issue that the design does usually cover or cater for, in that the hands will grab as hard as they can, then stop trying to grab. It's more about what happens when you knock the hand on the table as you walk past. What happens when you push out of a chair? When you've got these little digits with little fine gears and motors on them, how do they cope with getting dirty? How do they cope with getting wet? the actual just living, and you know, how many times do you wash your hands a day? Those very basic questions weren't answered in those initial products. They were a brave step forward, but in order to be practical, they weren't quite delivering.
What were they made of?
Well, I guess they're all made. All the products, including ours, are made of similar materials, and that's injected plastics and nylons and metals such as aluminium and stainless steel, and there's obviously electronics in there as well. But there is a range of mechanical approaches to addressing robustness, and each manufacturer is taking their own little twist on it, trying to address it. And in our case, we've taken that, we believe, to the next level.
So what? So I said in my intro that yours was the first waterproof hand.
Mm-hmm.
Why weren't the early ones waterproof?
Well, that's a decision that has to be made very early in the design process as to whether you're going to make a product waterproof or not. And that's the advantage we've had in coming to the market a little late. We've been able to hear what all the complaints and issues have been in the market.
Mm.
But to actually make something waterproof that is taking the sort of knocks that these things take, it's actually hard. And it's got to be a decision in the design process at day one.
Yeah, so what are they made of that isn't waterproof? I don't quite understand.
So there are a range of seals. So if you think about what a hand is doing, the fingers moving, those moving joints, they could, in theory, go rusty. So there might be some metal in there. There might be electronics around the joint. How do you stop that electronics from getting wet? There's certainly electronics in the body of the hand to drive all the motors. And what happens if a motor gets wet? So getting those seals to be able to seal the hand all the time and through all the joints of a hand, and there are a lot of joints in there, that is the trick. That's the challenge.
Mm. Okay, let's jump out of the Q&A for a moment, and why don't you tell me your story and how you ended up in this industry?
Well, it did go back away, back to 2002. I did have a mountain biking accident just in the back hills of Lower Hutt, and I managed to break both my arms in the elbow and the wrist in that fall, spiral break in one of the forearms as well. And although... I couldn't use my arms for several weeks because of the plaster, but one of the elbows also wasn't very functional for a couple of years after two or three surgeries, and I wasn't able to climb a ladder, for example, during that time. And it just, there were things during that time, especially that 3 weeks where I couldn't pick up the kids, I couldn't feed myself, brushing my teeth, you know, the very basic things. That was certainly one of the seeds of the journey. In what am I going to do next in my life? I was in my early 30s at the time. I should mention probably that it was also a time of evaluation anyway for me shortly after that, as I sort of was feeling the need that I should be trying to do a job that makes a difference in this world. And really it became a very overpowering emotion for me in the years that followed. So that kind of fed into, I think I'll be a prosthetist sort of concept. That was where it started, but that wasn't going to happen in that to train I had to go to Melbourne and had a mortgage and kids and family with lots to do in Wellington. So I did the next thing I could think of as being a trained engineer, and that was to start building hands in the garage. And that's kind of when it started to take some form.
I missed that. So you became an engineer after that, or you were already an engineer?
No, I had been trained back at the start of my career as an electronics engineer with quite a strong mechanical input into that training as well. I had branched into IT networking, and so in the years leading up to that mountain biking accident, I'd actually become quite removed from electronics. But I was at a point when... as I say, probably in my mid-late 30s, where I really needed a change and needed to know that I was heading towards making a difference to people somehow.
So when you went into the garage to try and make a hand, what did you discover? How tricky was it?
Yeah, building hands is hard, and a lot of people are doing it. If you've got a 3D printer and you go onto Thingiverse, which is where all the pre-made fabricated ideas are, there's plenty of hands in there you can print. At the time when I started doing it, there was no such. Well, the 3D printers had just come on the market for the consumer, so I was wrestling with the sort of materials to use, and I did have to get a 3D printer and started experimenting with that too. And it was a It was a slow process. It was an iterative process. One common thing kept happening when I started making these hands, and of course I didn't know that robustness was an issue in the products when I started making them, was the little finger would always break within an hour of making a hand. and so this was a frustration for me. By this time it was about 2010, 2011, so it was almost 10 years after that original accident. So there was a long process in working through to this as an idea. I think once I spoke to some global experts in the US, and they said, well, you're seeing the same issues we're seeing with the hands that we spend $50,000 on. It's the same problem. That was when the light really came on for me, and it was like, oh, well, this is actually an opportunity. I'm well positioned now to try and crack something. That's when I started trying to seriously solve the robust issue.
How'd you get on?
Where I ended up was that it didn't matter how stiff and strong you make a hand, it's always going to break on those little fingers in particular. And so instead the approach became, how do you make it flexible? How do you make it bend and return to that position from any angle?
And by the way, isn't it amazing that you're putting so much thought and presumably money into designing something that is just there at the end of each of our arms, right? So how perfect are hands that they have all these features? They're hard to break and they're flexible and they're waterproof.
I spent hours and hours just sitting looking at my hand. In fact, my wife got very fed up with me sitting in bed, waving my arm around and occasionally grabbing her arm and looking at it and throwing it away in disgust because it's so small that I couldn't possibly make a hand that small.
Yeah, great. Okay. So was there a breakthrough moment?
Well, it was a gradual process, but there was effectively a design for a hand. It was called the Cordia hand when it was labelled with the help of the company I worked for at the time. They funded me a little bit to get my first 3D printer, so that was Cordia. So it was called the Cordia hand. That hand had a number of hacksaw blades that had been cut and painted. So if you look at the pictures, I don't know whether you'll put them on your website or not, but there was a picture of the Cordia hand there. You can see there's four hacksaw blades making the structure of a palm that makes it flexible.
We do have pictures, by the way, people who want to have a look. Yeah.
Yeah, great. And there was a 3.5 mil drill bit in the back of that holding it together. You know, it was really cobbled together, but from that hand, we were able to print. Well, I was able to create videos. I was able to get a patent registered. I was able to show it off, and in all these sorts of journeys, where actually you go from something like an idea where people are looking at you like you're crazy to actually, getting to the finish line. There's almost always a moment in the journey for that particular product where there was a bit of luck, or there was a timing of technology that allowed that person to make that breakthrough when they did. And one of the breakthroughs for us in that journey was a call from a guy called Wallace Faraday, who's a Kiwi guy who's in the States. He works for our company called Hanger. They're the biggest prosthetic and fitting company in the USA. And so he's a Kiwi over there. He happened to catch up with a TVNZ article on the early hand, the Cordia hand, and gave me a call and invited me to go over to the USA and share what I was doing with them, even at this early stage. And that was quite pivotal because we were able to sit down, have a beer with a bunch of prosthetists that fitted what were absolutely bleeding edge devices at the time, and talk about them frankly and hear what the pain was, and the idea of robustness was key in those conversations.
Any concern there? I'd be worried about someone stealing my idea.
Well, I did have the patent registered before of that original design, but it was one of those sort of moments in the journey that you always remember, the first journey where I think the first funding had come in, so in what was it now? I'm just checking. I've got a list of dates in front of me here. In late 2014, that was when I first got to go over to the States, and I was coming into land in LA Airport and realised I was holding a 3D printed plastic hand that didn't work. It was only a model, that one, with the latest ideas, and it was in a $10 suitcase from the op shop. And here I was flying over the LA, coming in to see the biggest prosthetic company in the USA. Mm. How nuts is this?
Yeah.
But it was absolutely pivotal and fantastic for us to understand a little more. That is where the waterproofing concept was born. Was, you know, if you can make it waterproof, wow, that would really be something. So we came back with that as well.
So what is it that makes your hand different? I mean, was there something that where you sort of departed from everything that had been done before, and is it something that you can explain to us?
Well, the waterproofing is an easy enough concept to communicate, but there are a number of other concepts, and certainly this robustness issue, it can't be underestimated how hard that has. What a big impact that has made, having a device that can actually take the knocks.
Yeah, so how did you solve that?
Yeah, so what we've got essentially is a rubber block that sits just behind the knuckles, and all the fingers sit inside this. It's fairly stiff, but inside this rubber block. And so when you whack that hand on the table, and if anybody goes to the website www.taskerprosthetics.com, sorry, there was a bit unashamed throwing that in there.
That's right, it's linked from our side as well. Yeah.
But if you go to the website, right on the front page, you see the hand being smacked sideways on a wet table and being submerged, and even holding a steak knife, which is something that most of the other devices on the market can't do. It's just, it's taken that robustness step really to a level where patients can actually live an normal life, but they can live a far more active life. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, it's a great demonstration. It's a great video. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, the washing the hands is actually a really important one to grasp for those users out there that don't have to, listeners out there that don't have to think about this sort of thing typically, but, you know, you wash your hands so many times a day. So for a hand not to be waterproof, it's very awkward for someone to toilet themselves.
When did you sell your first one?
Yes, so we sold our first few to Australia back in, goodness, that was back in August 2017. We've just gradually been ramping up. We signed a distribution arrangement with a USA company in late 2017, and so last year was our first year on the market, and in the USA specifically, although we are selling hands in Australia and New Zealand as well.
Who is a prosthetic hand right for?
Mm-hmm. So that's actually a good question, because they're not right for everybody. The ideal patient is someone who has had an amputation well below the elbow but well above the wrist, so in that midsection, and that's because the hands can be quite heavy, so they weigh about 620 grams, which over the period of a day, that weight there can be quite a bit of fatigue associated with that weight. So that's the ideal person, but you can be sure that there's plenty of people out there that have got our hand on that, using it when it's even right up to the wrist or above the elbow, and they've got a prosthetic elbow as well. In fact, one of the people that work for us is above elbow amputee, and he's, of course, wearing a Tasker.
Mm. Kate in Helensville would like to know how soon after surgery you'd be considered for a prosthetic.
So the ideal position is to get somebody with a prosthesis on as soon as possible after their accident, and that is to prevent them from building bad habits. So the moment somebody is, I mean, you lose your hand, you're still going to try and use whatever you've got left to start doing tasks.
Yeah.
And if you do that, you start pushing out your shoulder. You start very quickly doing moves that will, over a long period of time, curve the spine and create issues late in life. So I guess typically the surgery will vary a little bit, but say 4 to 6 weeks after swelling, they should be fitted with a socket to get them underway. So within 3 months, conceivably, someone should have a hand on in an ideal scenario, maybe a little sooner.
We mentioned the number that had been purchased in the US. Mm-hmm. How many have you sold in New Zealand?
It's less than 10 at the moment. I think the thing to remember when you hear that is that upper limb amputations are a small percentage of a small amputee number. So upper limb, which is arms, is 4% of all amputations. And then within that, that includes fingers. So what it comes down to is about 120 people per million are appropriate for a myo hand. So that's a common term, myo device. So yeah, that's several hundred. And we've got a bit of a journey to do in New Zealand, obviously, to try and reach those folks.
So can you tell me about the impact that it has on someone when they try a prosthetic hand first time?
It's usually quite emotional. And I think the thing to remember is that using a hand is it's not a tool, or not just a tool, I should say. It is a expressive device. Mm. And to not be able to express yourself is part of the amputation experience. It's not just not being able to do tasks. So it for both the user and the fitting person, it can be quite a touching experience. In fact, it is always a touching experience, to be honest, to see that.
You set out to change lives, didn't you? Is that the experience that you're having?
Yes, although I'm a little removed from the day-to-day action, sadly. I would like to get closer to that fitting process. But, you know, as a young company, the foundations are still sitting on the concrete as we've only been sort of trading product for 18 months, and we're growing at a silly rate. It's a good in a good way, but we're growing by several staff a month. And so at the moment, it's all hands to the pump just to make sure that we grow in a way that doesn't let our patients down, and we look after the people that we bring on.
Lydia wants to, you sort of covered this, but Lydia wants to know if the hand can be used by someone who lost their hand, you know, a couple of decades ago.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I guess another shameless plug is that, you know, we want to hear from New Zealanders in particular. I mean, my passion, I didn't mention earlier, but I really would like to see our company be able to help Kiwi amputees. It will take us some time to get there, but you know, if you were to send an email to support@taskerprosthetics.com, we would be really keen to hear from you. And when the time's right, maybe a year or so away, we'll be in touch to try and work out whether we can help or not.
What's the hold up?
Well, as I say, it comes down to a good line, I think, which is you have to be a capitalist before you can be a socialist.
I like that. I haven't actually come across that one.
Yeah, look, we are, as I say, we are growing at a rate, but that's a hungry process from a money point of view. We haven't reached that kind of plateau of a whole system and manufacturing plant where we have all the people filling all the holes right now. It's a fantastic time, but it's a very busy time for us. So, you know, just have to hang on to your socks and wait for
You're backlogged and not taking any more orders.
We are only just able to keep up at the moment. And for a long time last year, we couldn't. So we kind of feel like we're starting to win, but the product has been extremely well received internationally.
Gillian says, does it have any effect on phantom pain?
Good question, Julian. The answer is yes. In all likelihood, it will help. Wow. And this is that weird connection between open nerves and how the brain interprets those. So you've got these nerves that, and during the accident, basically now are sitting there just listening and don't know how to interpret what they can hear. And the brain somehow has a way of looking at that and going, oh, it must be pain. You've got no hand. And when the body actually, the eyes and brain are able to interpret that there's a hand there where there wasn't one that was lost, the pain definitely can subside, and there's a feeling of even the fingers growing, and putting quotes in the air, fingers growing back into the prosthetic hand when it's being used, as a feeling of that. They call it extension, as the user sort of becomes more comfortable that this device is here. So there's this weird, not completely scientifically explainable sort of relationship between being able to see your hand or a prosthetic hand and the relationship of pain to it.
What's the cost?
It does depend a little bit on where in the world. It's set based on what the trends are in the different locations. So the price can vary between 35,000 NZ and 45,000 NZ, depending on where you are in the world.
Do you think that'll be a fixed price, a permanent price?
It has to be in the market regions we're working in. We are currently working with distributors, and so those prices have to be set for them to manage their business. There is clearly, as I mentioned, a passion for New Zealand specifically, and that does overflow to Australia a little. But since they won the cricket, I'm just a little hesitant about the Australian market right now. So we're really
fair
focused
enough
on Kiwis.
Fair enough. Do you do different colours?
Yes, so there's the standard hand is a black, and it's a dark grey, actually. Sorry, David, that's our design manager down in Christchurch. Dark grey, and then there is a sand coloured hand and a white coloured hand.
Oh, here's a tricky one. If a person has broken a wrist but has poor healing and limited movement plus pain, should they consider amputation and using your hand instead?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question.
David would like to know.
Sorry, I will answer it, but it really is. It does come down to that person's particular situation. There's no doctor that could give clear advice on that because it's such an expressive part of the body, even if it is painful. Yeah.
David, this is an interesting question, but it might spark something. He says, "Are any aspects of bird's bone structure utilised in hand construction?"
Ooh, well, that's a good thought for taking the natural design and making the most of hollow bones and so forth. If the question means do we use principles of bird bones in our design for hands, the answer is no. We have to approach it with the more metallic and plastic materials we've got to work with, unfortunately.
You got your eyes on feet? Been staring at your wife's feet in bed?
Look, the upper limb business, we've already got years of R&D and development in front of us, and we want to hear from people too, by the way, that want to get involved in that. So, there is, for example, smaller hands. We need to find some ladies to work with. At the moment, we've got we'll call them a medium and a large. So there's crossover to some woman size here, but we don't really have a good woman population to work with in developing that right now. There's also what happens when the amputation is actually beyond the wrist and actually midway into the hand area. There are some products right now that do address that, but not fantastically well. And we've got ideas around that too. So, we're pretty focused on the upper limb department.
What's been the overwhelming feedback from the 200 people in the US who've got your hands on?
It's not hard to see it, actually. If your listeners were to go to Instagram or Twitter and look for Tasker Hand or Tasker Global, there are a lot of very positive users out there, just absolutely wrapped to have their Tasker Hand. One of the other aspects of the product that we haven't touched on much is that the hand has got the ability for the user to actually change grip patterns very easily, and that also makes a big difference to users. The grip pattern is like whether they're doing a thumbs up Fonzie grip where the thumb comes down, or whether they're just doing a close around a glass, and being able to access different grips is actually another feature. And so that combined with the waterproofing and the robustness, really well received.
If you scratch that itch about wanting to help the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have, but I'm not done yet. And, there's still a few years in this to explore, so I'm excited for our future right now.
Nice one, Matt. You are obviously a very busy person, so I really appreciate you coming in for half an hour to chat to us about this, and thanks for all that you've done and for, I guess, the hope that you will have aroused in people listening today. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jesse. Pleasure.
That's Matt Jury. His company is Tasker Prosthetics, a New Zealand company that is making life-changing and world-beating hands. There are some photos on our website, and he says, get in touch if you want one. Might not be tomorrow, but hopefully within a year or so.